This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3009 for Thursday, the 13th of February 2020. Today's show is entitled Linux In-Laws S01-E01. It is the first show by new host Monochromec, and is about 60 minutes long, and carries an explicit flag. The summary is Linux In-Laws, a podcast about on topics around free and open source software. Today's show is licensed under a CC BY license. Dash.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
This is Linux In-Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software, any associated contraband, communism, the revolution in general, and whatever else fancies your tickle. Please note that this and other episodes may contain strong language, offensive humor, and other, certainly not politically correct language. You have been warned. Our parents insist on this disclaimer. Happy Mom! Thus, the content is not suitable for consumption in the workplace, especially when played back on a speaker in an open plan office or similar environments. Any minors under the age of 35 or any pets, including fluffy little killer bunnies, your trusty guide dog, unless on speed, and cute T-Rexes or other associated dinosaurs. Good afternoon, dear audience. This is the first, also called virgin episode of something called Linux In-Laws, a new podcast on open source technology. Martin, say something.
Okay, so I thought you were in the middle of a sentence to interrupt you. Right, so where were we? Right, Linux In-Laws, your friendly podcast, anything hacker related, anything cultural related, like good beers, for example. So essentially, your podcast on topics technical and fun.
And before we go into the before we go into any further details, let us introduce ourselves. So let me introduce myself. This probably won't be edited out, or maybe it will. I don't know. Anyway, my name is Chris Zimmerman. I'm a veteran, FOSS veteran, as in free and open source veteran. If you deploy your search engine of choice, if you just search for my name in a free and open source context, you will find me on things like Chemnitz and Linux-Tage, like Frostcon, which is the second major event here in Germany. I'm also in charge of a LUG here in Germany called the LUG Frankfurt, as in Linux User Group in Frankfurt. And I'm doing all sorts of fun things. As a matter of fact, shameless plug now from a commercial perspective, not. Next weekend, and this will be way over as when you hear this, because we won't be able to publish this on Hacker Public Radio before kind of mid-late February. At this stage, FOSDEM will be truly over, but if for some reason you manage to deploy your flux capacitor and go back in time, you can hear me in Brussels at the upcoming FOSDEM, speaking on something called Redis JSON, which is a document database running on top of our beloved NoSQL database called Redis.
So Chris, a quick question for you there. You mentioned Googling your name, and you sort of missed out the Tinder connection there. Was that on purpose, or is that for the listeners to find?
I thought we wouldn't be talking about this, Martin, as previously discussed.
Just checking.
Word of advice, listeners.
There may be some surprises.
This is a podcast not necessarily safe for the workplace. So you will hear swearing. This is not PG. This is more like triple X. Martin, why don't you introduce yourself now, being a frequent Tinder user?
Thank you.
You're more than welcome.
Right, so my name is Martin Visser. I am actually a Dutch person by birth, having lived in the UK now for 20 years. This is to be reconsidered shortly, I think, but that's a topic for another time. unlike Chris, I'm fairly new to open source, as in more than 8 years, not like the 30 he has been doing this, but likewise have been using various different softwares over my professional and amateur career. So we are both different part of Europe at the moment, having similar mind on some subjects, mainly the beer one, but there are others, of course.
Should we tell our beloved audience when and how we met, or should we keep this to a later show?
By all means, it's probably worth the listeners understanding the how two very different people got together.
Well, I mean, it's not exactly a secret, because in contrast to popular belief, no, the cartel didn't play any role in this. If you look it up on LinkedIn or other professional services, social networks, you'll see that we both work for a company called Redis Labs. And this is basically how and where we met quite some time ago.
Indeed. And I was actually warned before you arrived of your, characteristics by a fellow German.
Okay. But they didn't prevent you from joining.
indeed.
And our beloved audience probably would like to know that you haven't been looking back ever since you joined, I suppose.
That's correct. No. Looking back, we always look forwards, right? Forwards is...
Indeed. There's no point in looking back, no.
Although, obviously, things can be learned from history. But, yeah. Let's not mention that one.
probably some topic for another episode now. Okay, Martin, why are we doing this? And how we're going to go into a little bit of detail how we're doing this in about 5 minutes, but why are we doing this?
Because I think the main reason why we're doing this is, sorry, I'll let you finish.
Sorry, because there are quite a few open source podcasts around. You just have to take a look at Hacker Public Radio of what's out there, and some other podcasts that I normally sometimes listen to if I don't have anything else to do, tackle the subject of open source to a great extent, ranging from, of course, the beloved Floss Weekly. Randy, if you're hearing this, yes, this is your show. Right up to something like Open Source Underdogs, where I think it's Mike Schwartz or something tells us about the business side of open source. Well, so Martin, why do we need another podcast?
Because there is nothing like it already, obviously. Otherwise, it wouldn't be bothering. This podcast is there for us to, you know, you may think, oh, who are these two old farts just rambling on about open source software and beer, and I could spend my time better looking at adult websites, right? But you will be surprised by the value you are getting from this.
Does your wife still allow this? As in, you look at adult websites?
She's not currently in the room.
Perfect. Yeah. Yeah, what's the point in looking at Arab websites if you do, if you can do a podcast? That's spot on. Yes, of course. What Martin really means, it's not O2 old files talking about open source technology, but rather some cool tech content that you can use. And this is something where you come in actually, to because this podcast, although it's called Linux In-Laws, it's not just about us. It's about you. To a great extent, because at the end of the day, it's your show. So there's a website called linuxinlaws.eu. We're going to mention that at the very end of the show, just again, where you can send mail to, and the mail address is feedback@linuxinlaws.eu. And we are really looking forward to your feedback, what we can put into the show. That ranges from tech tips, to any topics that you see fit. If you have any suggestions about the format, so for example, if you want to have more surreal bastard operators from hell episodes, just send us your suggestions and we take a look at them. Also, if you have any technical questions that we can basically look up on our search engines of choice to come up with the most likely answer that may answer that question, feel free to do so. So essentially, we are looking, we're going to do anything or everything that other podcasts don't do. And for this, we are looking for your feedback.
Yeah. So Chris, what about the competition of hacking this website? Do we publish that this series, or are we leaving that for a later date?
Obviously no,
with some splendid prizes.
No, actually, the website, of course, cannot be hacked. That goes without saying. Any other people or people just attempting to do so, bear in mind, we are both hardened IT security experts.
Somewhat than others.
We're not black hats, don't get us wrong here, but if you try to hack the website, you better should be prepared for the consequences, let's put it this way. If you know what a remote access trojan is, then you don't want to hack the website. If you want to find out, just go for it. I'm only joking. No, there won't be rats coming your way if you want to try to hack the website, but it's not nice anyway, so.
Excellent. So there we are with our introduction. now, our how do you get this to the this kind of setup working, right, Chris? What do you think is the main requirement for any listener wanting to produce a podcast like this?
Interesting topic because what you essentially need is something called the internet. Not sure if you've heard about it. It all came to fruition basically when people were thinking about the idea of sharing cat videos. trouble is, at the time, about 40 years back, they had to use carrier pigeons or something like this. So some bright spark came up with the idea of interconnecting computers in order to do that. And without this whole internet thing, the podcasts, not just our one, but also basically other distributed podcasts, are quite
many carrier pigeons.
Tricky, indeed. Yes, indeed. So essentially, let's run through this. So if any budding podcast people are out there, we use pretty much a standard setup. We are using Mumble, like many other podcasts, because Martin is in the UK, I'm in Germany. So we are running a Mumble instance on one of Martin's servers. We are also using Riot as a matrix server, a matrix instance, in order to exchange messages.
And other content,
yes. For those of you who are wondering about these building blocks, there will be links in the show notes. What else do we need? What else do we use more? We, of course, we use something called emails quite a lot, actually.
Well, I mean, in my scenario, the first thing that came to mind was not to use your kit because that didn't work. So I ended up setting it all up myself. Then there was obviously various amounts of fiddling with routers required to get all these ports open, firewalls, etc. And not to mention reading the manual.
Which is something that Martin doesn't know. Of course, the reason why my kit didn't work is that Martin, let's put it this way, was in need of some professional training in terms of how to administer Linux servers and that sort of thing. So somebody got in touch. Martin, sorry, I can't name any names, of course. And they thought it might be a good idea because your dev skills are quite good, but your op skills somewhat could be improved. So that's the reason why they said, no, look, let Martin do the whole thing. And then basically we can take it from there. And apparently that worked quite well.
It has worked. Yes, indeed. I see. But it was a worthwhile experiment also. So.
Yes, indeed. Okay, a couple of fun facts. Mumble isn't straightforward. So is Mormer, the server behind Mumble. Maybe now is the time to go into a little of detail of how this whole thing works. Mumble/Mormer is a voice over IP system that uses TCP/UDP in order to send speech or general audio information around. It does require a little bit of fiddling if you run this on Linux/OSX as we do. So for starters, for example, you want to stay clear of something called voice activated speech, I think it's called MAN, right?
Correct, yeah.
So because Mumble, which is the default client, or which is the standard client rather for Mormer, Mormer is the server side, Mumble is the front end client, it has the ability of detecting voice, but this messes up your audio stream, especially when you record this. So we are resorting to continuous or continuous, something called push to talk. Yes. You also want to make sure that the transmission speed is okay. Why don't you shed some light on your initial woes with regards to ICMP throttling?
Because initially we started, Chris set all this up on his kit and Mumble as well as the Mormer server, Riot. And we found that there was a considerable delay in audio. So there was some experimenting going on in terms of, as you do in terms of networking, where is the delay, right? So the round trip time was around 30 milliseconds. So, you know, that doesn't really explain a 3-second delay, right? So we had a brilliant idea about using MTR to track the location of these delays. And turns out that various ISPs do various throttling at various points in the way over to the outside world.
For those of you who do not know MTR, think trace route on a good day. In terms of MTR, does a continuous trace route on between your side and the destination, giving you the overall packet loss. It just used TCP, but I think you can convince it also to use UDP, meaning that you not only get an overview of the overall packet loss, but also of about the round trip side, which is pretty important if you're dealing with audio packets, because something that audio doesn't like is jitter, as in variable delays, because essentially that will kill your audio stream to a certain extent if the line doesn't match up with regards to a maximum amount of jitter. Latency audio can cope with to some extent, but jitter is really bad for your audio stream. Also something that we found out, yes, you can use TCP, and that works, I think, just a little bit better than UDP, right, Martin?
Yeah, there's various options in terms of the sound and compression quantities on Mumble, which are all very easy to configure anyway, to be honest, in your friendly audio settings button. So obviously the quality in terms of compression, amount of audio per packet, etc. So these are all, essentially, it required a lot of experimenting before we got the workable setup here.
Yes.
Being in two different countries.
Yes, it wasn't straightforward. And if you want to set it up that way, and this is basically what I heard from other podcasts too, whether it's going to be the Ubuntu podcast in the UK, which had a whole episode on how their kit worked or how they got a kit working at the end of the day. Other podcasts that are kind of distributed geographically. You're talking about, I think the Ubuntu people synchronize it's even down to synchronizing clocks on their side. We haven't gotten that far, but then we're just starting out. Hmm. But be prepared to do some serious amount of experimenting before you get it right. And even this is just us being two people doing a podcast. Needless to say, there will be some sort of limited post processing. And for this, I'm using audio, something that I just found out this afternoon. For all you budding Mac experts out there or Mac fans, Audacity at least 2.3.3, as in 2.3.2, does not run on Catalina. So if you are Mojave with regard to OSX, you want to stay there if you want to use Audacity. But of course, there's nothing from preventing you of taking the audio file and then moving this to the Linux box of your choice and doing the post-production there.
You haven't mentioned any Windows users out there, Chris. Is that for a reason? Or?
What is Windows?
Microsoft Windows, no?
Microsoft Windows doesn't ring a bell. Do explain, please.
Okay. Well, this is quite a large proportion of home users are still using this so-called operating system. But
Okay. It's not open source, is it?
I don't believe so. No.
That's probably the reason why I don't know that. But now that you mention it,
it's just say our listeners, some of our listeners may be on Windows, right? So what advice do you have for them?
This Windows thing does it's been around for some time, right?
It has.
Like 20, 30, 25, 30 years? Yeah. That funny anecdote comes to mind. Some people are referring to this Windows thing as a bootloader to boot up something called WSL, the Windows subsystem for Linux, I think it's called. I've seen smaller bootloaders to be honest with you, but I think if you are still on this Windows thing, you may want to consider WSL, and if you want to use open source software, because this is what you get when you use WSL, you get a user land of choice. For you with that, whether it's Ubuntu, whether it's OpenSUSE, whether it's Fedora, whether it's something else, just go to the corresponding websites down and take a look at what's out there, and then basically you can boot into your Linux distribution of choice, leaving this grand bootloader called Windows aside, if you're so inclined, that is.
Oh, that's a very handy tip there for our listeners. I'm sure they'll appreciate this. Assuming there are any on Windows, of course.
Yes.
we may be targeting the wrong audience.
For those of you who are still on Windows, fret not, you can move to Linux. It's always an option. Especially if you're technically inclined, this is the platform of choice for you to be on.
Any comments on particular Linuxes to use for our listeners there?
That's a very interesting question, actually. Yes, it depends on the amount of time that you have at your disposal and the learning curve that you're willing to invest into. Linux can be as easy as Linux Mint if you're so inclined, in terms of just download an ISO, put it on a stick, boot it up, and then the stick pretty much does it all for you. this is the one side of the coin. The other side of that chart, of that kind of circle, if you will, is actually something called Arch, or if you want to go further down that rabbit hole, Linux from Gentoo, or even Linux from scratch. And you may wonder, especially if you're new to Linux, what this all is. Linux from scratch essentially means you have a couple of recipes. Some people refer to it as a cookbook, that allow you to build your own Linux distribution from scratch, and hence the name. Because essentially what you do is you take another computer, you compile your Linux kernel on that other computer, you put together an initial user land, as in the stuff that runs once the kernel is up and running. Sorry, the kernel is, of course, the underlying system software that talks to the hardware, gives applications memory, and does other fun stuff. For example, shoveling network packets around the system and so forth. Once you have this minimal user land up and running, you can configure then your Linux system further based on your specific requirements. When using Linux from scratch, that means pulling down the source code, as in the source code where all the applications are made of, and compiling that on your minimal user lands, giving you at the end of the day a fully customized Linux system based on your specific requirements. Gentoo is a step up the ladder in terms of a package-based Linux system, where you pull down the source code in a packaged form from so-called repositories, but still compile it on your machine. Or sometimes also pulling down already pre-compiled packages. And Arch then is again a little bit more user-friendly, where you download just packages. You have something called the Arch user repository that also most of the time consists of source code that is then compiled in your machine. But these three options are more for the technically inclined user of Linux who doesn't mind spending a good deal of time, especially when going for, let's say, Linux from scratch, or even Gentoo, or the other way around, rather. Arch, as I said, is a little bit more user friendly. Full disclaimer: you're listening to something called an Arch package maintainer. Full disclosure: I do maintain Arch packages. Not for a living, but just for a hobby, so I might be slightly biased here. Martin, what Linux distribution did you start off with?
You mean originally, or in our current setup?
No, these 25 years ago when you first used Linux.
That's a good question, Chris. The main Linuxes around back then were HP. Obviously Solaris, and those were the original ones that were around in the Linux land. Obviously working in a corporate organization, that's the ones that were used back then.
Okay. So you've given away the fact that we are both old, which is okay.
Well, some are older than others, but
true.
It is all relative, after all. I wouldn't call you quite a dinosaur there, Chris, but
thank you. Much appreciated.
I think we are experienced and knowledgeable, I think is the phrase, rather than old. That's how I would describe
The reason why we're not doing a video streams, that we're not doing video stream like other podcasts yet, is simply that I can't be bothered to wear makeup, and Martin is, I think, too old for wearing makeup.
And it would mean moving out of your pajamas as well, wouldn't it, really? Some distinct disadvantages there, all these extra clothes required.
Martin keeps throwing up words that I don't know. Martin, what are pajamas?
Okay.
No, don't send pictures, Martin. Don't send pictures. That's okay.
I shall access right now.
Oh dear, Martin, you didn't have to do this, you know. This looks disgusting. What is that cat doing on your lap?
I'm glad we are here. I think most cases so far, been able to have our own rooms when in a similar location. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, Martin. Just for the benefits of the listeners, Martin just sent a cat picture on Riot, which is not fit for public consumption. So we leave it at that. And no, that won't be in the show notes, Martin.
Good. So you don't mind me putting up the bunny picture on the website with you in it?
You can try, but it'll be removed in no time. Okay, back to safe rounds, on with the infrastructure discussion. Okay, yes. Martin, why don't you get us started with after you graciously declined to use my Matrix server, why don't you shed some more light on the installation that you were doing and your woes with reverse proxies?
Well, not so much woes. It's having multiple. Okay, so first of all, I'm running this all at home behind a simple router, which is serving multiple purposes, so not a dedicated piece of.
Sorry to interrupt, Martin, but maybe we should explain what Matrix is first and what Synapse is. Maybe you can shed some more light on federated communication tools. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, I thought we were talking about the woes of the installation. That's fine.
Synapse is a Matrix reference installation, and Martin is, before he goes into the technical details, we'll shed some light within 2 or 3 minutes. Yes, we'll be clock, Martin. what Matrix really is and why it's important.
Good point. Right. So we are all familiar with communication tools like your corporate Slacks being probably the main one these days. Kind of Skype missed the boat there somewhat, after having been taken over by our friends from Microsoft. But
friends, I see.
Well, they are very friendly people, people at Microsoft. Have you not dealt with them before? Yeah, that's... Well, actually, Skype was originally a company in Estonia. And again, they are very friendly people, if Estonian. So, right, going back to, where were we?
What is a federated communication server?
Ah, yes, a federated communication server. So rather than having a central server where everybody connects to and sends their messages and receives their messages, the idea about federation is obviously that it is a completely shared setup where every server in the communication mechanism plays its part. So there is no one central control. So for the communists amongst us, this is a very attractive setup. Although it is arguably that communism was it's Chris's favorite topic, by the way. Just to mention this for our listeners as well. It's more of a centralized.
To be detailed in a later episode, perhaps.
Okay.
Just in case our listenership is wondering. Yes, it'll be all revealed, maybe.
Okay. We will leave that one for a later date. Yes. So yeah, that was our choice of communication software, which Chris kindly started to set up on his own server. Could we call it server? Or,
yes, it is a server. Funny enough,
it doesn't quite perform as a server, but hey, it's I was led to believe it was a server. So. There we go. So yes, you obviously require a Linux server of some sort to run both Matrix and Numble. Now, your choice of OS here is entirely up to you. Chris has just given you a rundown of some options there, which you may or may not want to spend more or less time on. But those of you who don't want to spend much time, your choice is Ubuntu. After having spent many years using, obviously, the Red Hats and the CentOS's, I have come round to the practicality or the benefits of using a more adopted platform like Ubuntu, which doesn't require you to compile pieces of software over and over again because all the packages are out of date. So yes, Chris, what's the next version are you running on your server?
Being a hardcore system admin for so many years, of course I use something called Debian.
See, very good.
Which
very
is good. Of which, of course, Ubuntu is a blatant ripoff. What Martin, of course, didn't discover when he first kind of came to the Linux front about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, maybe even more. And that there are different grades of Linux when it comes down to, let's put it this way, being up to date with current version of the software. And of course, the name CentOS is a little bit of a giveaway, because what CentOS stands for is a community enterprise operating system, essentially taking Red Hat sources and packaging them up as a, well, free version of Red Hat. So for those people, for those of our listeners who don't know, Red Hat is a subscription-based service where you pay a little bit of money, or much money depending on your number of subscriptions. And for that, you get hardened packages, you get hardened versions of the upstream software. But also what most people spend money for is support. So if your Red Hat system breaks down, you can call somebody and you will get help in order to fix that problem. CentOS is without support, so you simply install it on your server and then you're left to your own devices. Given the fact that both distributions are aimed at the enterprise, that the update policy is quite conservative, let's put it this way. And this is basically what Martin found out, that most of the packages are, I wouldn't say stale, but rather outdated or older, let's put it this way. Some people would also say more mature.
More secure.
Meaning that with CentOS or RHEL, you get packages that are easily 2 to 3 years old. Now, if you want to be at the very forefront of software deployment and maybe to some extent also development, you want to go for a more recent, or you want to go for a distribution that has a more up-to-date, let's put it this way, packaging policy. So Fedora comes to mind if you want to stay in the Red Hat realm. Fun fact, what are the two most important characteristics of something called a Linux distribution? Any guesses?
Characteristics.
Yes. As in, why do people go for a specific distribution apart from software packaging policies?
The general consensus is obviously the availability of software, right?
I would more play along the lines of the package management system and the logo.
But this is because you are a the logo.
Okay. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Hey, what do I know about Linux?
Well, this is exactly the point, right? Your Linux knowledge and the requirements are quite different to the general public, who just want things to run. That is kind of a minimum spec for a piece of software.
In that case, Linux distributions are like cars, right? You know one of them, but they all have four wheels. They all have a handbrake, they all have a steering wheel, and at the end of the day, they get you from A to B, right? So is Linux. Every distribution basically has a bootloader, has an init system, but then the differences start with the package management system and do not end at the logo question. Of course.
The thing is that on your Ubuntu you can run, or your CentOS, whichever, is a certain version of, say, so take a piece of software like Matrix or like Mumble or Murmur, whatever you want to call it. You can run certain versions of support out of the box, right, with your package manager, whereas with your car, that is a completed piece of engineering that doesn't really have many options to say, oh, let's install a fifth wheel or another steering wheel. Whereas that's not quite a good comparison, in my opinion, if you're talking about. So very, very bad analogy there, Chris. I have to pull you up on that one, I'm afraid. Yeah.
Fair enough. Although we are triple X podcast, I cannot kind of use other examples. We will probably keep that for a later special episode, but thanks for the credit, Martin. Much appreciated.
No problem.
Okay, back to my original train of thought there, Martin. It would be interesting to see. I'm dead sure that you didn't, or that you weren't able to use the reference implementation of Matrix called Synapse from your distribution management, or were you? How did you install Synapse on your server?
I didn't have to compile it in the end. No, that was, if that's what your question is.
Synapse, for those of you who don't know, is a Python code base.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning Martin probably did install it with something called pip.
Of course. Did I? I thought this was all to be revealed on the website. No, I'm sure I did a simple package manager install on that one.
Okay, for those of you who don't know, what pip is, and that may or may not include Martin. pip is a Python. No, Martin, you don't have to Google this. I'm going to explain it in a minute.
Okay, I'm just doing something else in the meantime.
Which is fair enough. No, pip of course is a package management system for Python. In contrast to DNF, which is used on Fedora-like systems, or even RHEL, or APT on Debian, pip only caters for Python. So any Python packages you want to install, you can install through pip, and Synapse would be one of them. With any other package management system, it does, for example, look after dependencies.
So having chosen the correct operating system, it was a simple matter of an APT install, actually.
Right. So you are using Ubuntu 16.04 the second last LTS?
18.
1804, okay.
Why 16?
Because you're old?
Well, no, if you're installing something. You don't want to go for the latest. So this is a handy tip for you listeners. Never go for the latest version. Go for the one before the latest version, which is obviously 18, since currently 19 is the latest. For your information, Chris. Yeah.
We should probably explain what an LTS is. LTS, of course, stands for long-term support. These are typical distributions. You have them, I think, Ubuntu or Canonical, the company behind Ubuntu coined the term. These are distributions that are, or version of the distribution rather, that are supported for a number of years, where, for example, Canonical with ordinary versions of the distribution only have a support window of what, I think, 9 months these days. It used to be, I think, a year, but now it's down to 9 months. So for production systems, including your adult entertainment content distribution network, your home theater PC, I would normally go for an LTS. The trouble, of course, is that with the LTS, software can be somewhat outdated unless a distribution decides to backport the new software packages back to the LTS, which some of the operators do, but some of them don't. How did we get here? Yeah, I was giving out to you about pip, right?
Yes, no, I didn't have to use pip for Matrix in this case. Yeah, so I think you are a bit of a fan of Python, aren't you, Chris?
Oh yeah, I've been using Python for the last 20 years, give or take.
I'm sure I heard a rumor you are currently investigating Java as a better option.
These are false accusations, of course. what Martin is referring to, the upcoming FOSDEM presentation, or the past FOSDEM presentation, if you're picking this up later, included some performance benchmark framework called YCSB, as in Yahoo Cloud Serving Benchmark. Yes, that's what it is. Okay, maybe two sentences on this without kind of doing a blatant commercial for the presentation. If you're interested in document-oriented DBs being implemented in Rust, deploy your search engine of choice and look for Redis JSON, Zimmerman, which is my second name, and FOSDEM 2020. You will come across a talk that I gave on the 2nd of February 2020. So a few weeks back, if you're picking this up from Hacker Public Radio, on the difference between Redis JSON and Redis JSON 2. Both are extensions, document database oriented extensions running on top of Redis. Redis JSON is implemented in C, and Redis JSON 2 is implemented in Rust. And for this, I had this idea of putting them next to each other in terms of performance to see what you get when you switch from C as your primary implementation language for this Redis JSON version 1 to Rust, which was the implementation language of choice for this extension for Redis JSON 2, yes. And for this, I used a benchmarking framework called YCSB. The trouble, of course, with this benchmark framework, it's written in Java. Martin warned me against using Java. His words: "If you see Java, run." At the time, juvenile that I was, about 2 months back, I blatantly
eight many years since.
I blatantly disregarded this. But as many times before, Martin was spot on. If you see Java, run.
It's worked for me so far. Yeah.
Yes. No, jokes aside, why did I use YCSB? Okay, first of all, some explanations about this. If you want to do a benchmark on a Java on a database, you want to use a framework that is widely accepted. The like trouble with TPC. YCSB is, yes, that would be the second choice, but and this I think is written in C, which is even worse, I think. Anyway, it doesn't matter. No, YCSB has the advantage, for want of a better expression, of being widely accepted in the community. As far as I know, and Martin, correct me if I'm wrong, because you used to work for full disclosure, you used to work for EnterpriseDB, right? There are only two accepted benchmarks in the NoSQL space, and that would be TPC minus C and YCSB. Mm-hmm.
The difference being that obviously TPC is a council with many members constructing these benchmarks, whereas YCSB, as the name says, was created by Yahoo for their own purposes. So not that suitable for a general database comparison test framework, one might consider.
Funny fact there is, the majority of NoSQL benchmark community members use YCSB for performance benchmarking. Java or...
No, they're all wrong, obviously.
Goes without saying, Martin. Goes without saying. So, I've never been kind of really looking into TPC, but the idea of behind YCSB is because it's a framework, essentially. You write a very thin layer that basically hooks up the client-side implementation of your database server with YCSB. And in the case of Redis JSON, it was only about 150, maybe 200 lines of Java code. Because there's a standard client called Jedis, which is the second standard client for Redis in the Java world. The other one, is, I think it's called Lettuce.
Why is that one second, Chris?
Adoption.
Okay.
Lettuce is done by Pivotal, if I'm not completely mistaken, and it's slightly more powerful than Jedis. But Jedis is really fast as far as speed goes for Java. And at the expense of being less powerful. So all I had to do for hooking up this YCSB framework in to Redis JSON was actually just to write the thin interface layer between the framework and something called JRedisJSON, which essentially is a Java side is a Java based client side library that in turn interfaces to Jedis to talk to Redis, and hence the kind of minimal volume of code that I had to write in order to make this performance benchmark. And if you're interested in the details, the slides plus the probably recorded presentation will be online by the time you're hearing this. Turns out that if you're staying away from a single threaded client side benchmark, you're only paying about 10% performance penalty when using the Rust-based code base rather than the C-based one. At the benefit, of course, of having a much, I wouldn't say much superior, but superior implementation language at your disposal. But Rust is probably the topic for another show, because I don't want to put Martin to sleep right now. Martin, you're still awake there.
I am here, of course. Yes. Sorry, I was just browsing. Yeah.
Excellent.
Not naming any.
Any cool cat videos coming up, Martin?
You know something with cats, isn't there? You do like your cats, by the sound of it.
Okay. Is there anything else that we should talk about when explaining the setup that we use?
I think it's probably easier to do this in the website as we have planned to do, but there are a number of pitfalls and considerations, certificates, reverse proxies, firewalls, you name it, port forwarding.
Martin,
not to mention reading the manual.
Martin, why don't you tell us a little bit about your experience with reverse proxies when hooking up Synapse to the greater internet?
It was fine, except that obviously the port was already used by something else, so I had to do a bit of other. So that was all great. So I thought, well, since I'm exposing this to Chris, I need to lock down everything as much as possible, implementing many firewalls, which obviously blocked port 8448, and then he wanted to use stickers for whatever reason to put his bunnies on there. I don't know.
Fun fact, kids, if you want to use stickers in your ride or other front end, you want to make sure that you enable federation on your Synapse server. But also, in addition to this, you want to ensure that the reverse proxy is able to talk on port 8443. Otherwise, your Synapse instance won't be able to talk to the federation, and you won't be able to download sticker packs. Yeah, what Martin doesn't know, I'm on a server anyway, port firewall or not, but that's probably the subject for another kind of episode, I suppose.
Excellent. Yes, that's a good challenge.
Okay,
if you make it onto my server, I'll buy you a beer. Let's put it that way.
You may want to start saving for a crate of beer right now.
Sure.
Okay. And of course we use write-web as the front end, which has the advantage of being available on OS X, Linux natively. I use it as a snap on Ubuntu, and of course mobile platforms like Android or iOS, if you're so inclined. I think it's React based, which has the advantage of being pretty stable on these platforms. And that's, I think, pretty much it.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can federate it to other chat software of your choice, like Slack, etc. Should you wish to do so.
Of course, Matrix being a federated communication network, you can also federate it to other Matrix instances, and it has a variety of interfaces to other services. Okay, before we put any remaining listeners to sleep, maybe we should call it a day for today. This is, if you're still awake, you've made it. You have listened to the first episode of something called Linux in Laws. I hope you liked it as much as we did.
The name will be a topic of a separate podcast, I'm sure.
Hence, it has nothing to do with Linux Outlaws Fab. If you're listening, that name has already been trademarked. You're too late.
It's the improved version, of course.
Okay. Again, what I said in the beginning, this is your podcast. So whatever you see fit to be included, let us know. The email, because we are still working on the website, the email is feedback@linuxinlaws, no dash, no hyphen, no comma, no nothing. feedback@linuxinlaws.eu. Send us your feedback, send us your email. We are not on Twitter.
Please do.
We're not on Twitter yet, and I don't think we will ever be there. So email is probably the communication medium of choice to let us know. We will probably include at some stage some feedback form on the website, but we are not there yet. So, Martin, do you want to get us started on the picks?
Of the cats or the bunnies? Or
no, picks in terms of anything that you want to blatantly promote right now before we close up show, before we close off the show.
Ah, no, I think we've probably overloaded our dear audience with enough fun and information for one episode. So I think we should leave it at that and get them to give their suggestions to us for any other episodes they would like to hear.
Great. And of course, these topics don't necessarily have to be confined to Linux. I mean, this initial show was leaning heavily on Linux because this is our operating system of choice for any serious things. For other stuff, we may use OS X or this thing called, what's it called again? Windows, right? Anyway. okay. But any open source topic goes. Other shows might not be as technical as this one. As I said, anything that crosses your mind, right from licensing, impact of open source on society, communism in general, as Martin already hinted at, anything goes. Again, feedback at Linux.
Yes.
Feedback at Linux .eu is the email address to use. And for the time being, just a word of advice, we will stay on Hacker Public Radio. That means we are only able to publish on the available slots. We plan to do this podcast about once a month, maybe every 2 weeks, depending on the available time. And until further notice, You will see us on Hacker Public Radio. We may move the show to to one of our personal service later on, but as I said, for the time, HPR is your go-to option of choice. Stay tuned and look forward to having you around for the second episode. Thank you for listening. This episode is brought to you by Spam. Feeling lonely and yearning for a little TLC? Fret not. Just go to RussianBrides.com, SupersizeYourLoveLife.net, or similar value-added websites and enter your email address. Within no time, you will receive wonderful, educating, and passionate messages explaining the benefits of herbal remedies for your love life, offering you a fortune for the small favor of funding a minor transaction from Nigeria through your bank account, and how to really get rich with cryptocurrencies. Totally legit, of course. You may even get that lucky break with a beautiful single lady right from Siberia who has been longing for a man or woman with only a few strings attached, just like you. Romance awaits. All for the little price of a mail address. Spam. What would we do without it? This podcast is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution. Credits for the intro music go to Bluesy Roosters for their song Salute Margot, and to Twin Flames for their piece called The Flow. You find these and other ditties licensed under Creative Commons at Jamendo, a website dedicated to liberate the music industry from choking copyright legislation and other crap concepts.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.